2nd, November 1973, and I'm going to start interviewing Peter Metzger at the Max Planck Institute in Bonn. Now, you actually began in France, is that correct?
Yes, I began in France, and in fact, I was studying at the Technische Hochschule in Munich, which is a sort of an institute for technology, and didn't hear one single lecture in astronomy. But then I got a scholarship for France, and at the time I was working as a summer student at the Siemens Research Laboratory, and my boss there, Professor Klein, who is well known in
Yes, I've seen his name on a couple old German Klein.
He was primarily concerned with the development of electronic tubes, mm-hmm. and later on with traveling wave tubes and things like this. So he was after the war in France, he had pretty good connections, and he in fact wanted to get me into a laboratory at the CSF, a Compagnie Générale de Télégraphie Sans Fil. But those guys didn't feel like taking a German from their competitors, and so Klein remembered that he knew Rocard, who was the director of the École Normale, and he talked to him, and Rocard told him, yes, get that guy in, and we'll see what we can do. It turned out that at that time in the École Normale, nearly all laboratories did classified work for the Marine Nationale or similar institutions, and there was only one institute which more or less did free work, and this was the laboratory which was headed by Denis on radio astronomy.
So you didn't go there specifically to do radio astronomy?
Oh, not at all. Yeah. I didn't have the foggiest idea. I mean, when Klein told me about something, he told me as they are looking at old stars which have exploded some 100 years ago.
Yeah.
I didn't have the foggiest idea about this whole thing. So, but I, of course, knew a lot about electronics, and so the laboratory accepted me, and the people with whom I was involved most was Denis, and Steinberg, and Blum.
And you went there what year?
That must have been in 1954. 53 or 54, I'm no longer exactly certain, but I could look it up if it is of interest.
Yeah.
And the laboratory at that time was primarily working on solar. In fact, I think exclusively working on solar radio astronomy. They didn't have the telescope in Nancy. Their prime instruments were some smaller solar interferometers and a Würzburg Riese telescope, which was one of these leftovers of the German Air Force. A 7.5-meter telescope, very deep reflector, and which was mounted in Marcoussi. And with this telescope, we made observations at 30 centimeters. And I can remember, and then we had some of these dipole walls for observations at lower frequencies.
What? Where was this located again?
In Marcoussi.
Where is that?
That's a sort of a suburb of Paris. I can't even tell you in which direction it is, but I think it was south or southwest. And it was probably some other research station, and they had the telescopes.
Right.
Now, Denis was primarily working on theoretical problems. He had at that time a very good reputation as a theorist primarily concerned with radiation from the sun and from plasma. And Steinberg was involved in observations and construction of receivers. I think he was the first man who had so roughly looked into, measured some of the problems related to this Dicke switched receivers. And Blum was concerned with the development of receivers for lower frequencies. I think he had already at that time some interest in interferometers. I think so, yes, we are just in the process of constructing a two-element interferometer. Also, again, with two of these Würzburg Riese dishes, which later on was used by Lequeux to measure a number of interferometrically measure a number of radio sources. But that was already at the time when they prepared the move to Nancy. There was another guy involved at the days in radio astronomy, with the name Leroux.
Yes, yes.
And he's not very well known in radio astronomy. And also he was a highly intelligent man. He didn't speak one word of a foreign language, and so he didn't any ever go to any meetings. Highly original man, was involved in the development of low noise mixers and later on parametric amplifiers, but he switched as easily to theory. But he somewhere got sidetracked and wanted to reinvent quantum mechanics from some of the Maxwell's equation, things that obviously other people have looked for too, and then he got lost for radio astronomy. He's now a professor for theoretical physics in I think it's the University of Rennes or somewhere.
I see. I've seen his name, but he left the picture when? In the early 50s? In the mid-50s?
Mid or end 50. I think it was rather end 50. As a paper he is probably best known for, he was the first man to settle this question of the polarization of synchrotron radiation.
Yes,
so
right.
That's for his contribution. Well, this was my... Okay, and I worked there for 1 year, and... at least I got some ideas about astrophysics. I still can remember one evening when we were sitting on the roof of the École Normale, and Dennis outlined to me Milky Way, and that is this flat system, and that's why you see this narrow strip.
Yeah.
Okay, but at that time I was primarily interested in instrumentation, and then I came back to Germany, and I wanted to go back to Siemens Research Laboratories where I came from. And at that time, Germany had gotten the money to build a 25-meter radio telescope.
Right. The only other radio astronomy going on was at the Heinrich Hertz Institute, is that correct?
Yes, at the Heinrich Hertz Institute. This was a department of the Heinrich Hertz Institute under Hachenberg. Worked, I think, rather exclusively at those days at Solar.
Right. Well, he's told me about that, of course.
Yeah.
But was there any other radio astronomy going on?
Yeah, there were two smaller groups, one in Kiel with Unseld.
And that's right. They did do some observations up there, yes.
Yes.
Priester told me about those a little bit. Yeah.
The instrumental man had the name Dröge, and Priester was the astrophysical man, and they made a survey of the whole sky at 150 megahertz. So I think this was a pretty good contribution to German radio astronomy in these days. And at about the same time, when this money was given for the 25-meter telescope, then Becker, who was the director of the Bonn University Observatory in those days, looked around for people to work on this project, and he got Priester from Kiel as a sort of astrophysical man, and he hired me at that time as the instrumental man. Now, the driving force behind the 25-meter telescope was Brandt, Leo Brandt, Secretary of State of the County of North Rhine-Westphalia for basic research. I think it's the only position which I knew of in any of the German states. He had a member of the Socialist Party, has had very good connections to everybody. During the war, he was the head of the radar development. I think first of Telefunken, but if I know, if I remember correctly, then he had the whole operation. Telefunken then got all the efforts, coordinated all the efforts of other companies. So he was he was too high up in the hierarchy. He was an administrator and no longer a technical man. But then, after the war, of course, any German activity on the radar, or anything connected with radar, I think even waveguides was, or building of magnetrons or kleinstrons, was highly forbidden. And then came up this radio astronomy, and...
When was it disallowed to begin microwave work again?
This I could not tell. I think at the time when I started, most of the restrictions had fallen. The only restrictions I can still remember in those days were for electrometer tubes. Tubes where you measure very weak currents and needs primarily nuclear physics. But I think the waveguide restrictions had already fallen.
So they were able to do the solar astronomy with just dipoles.
Well,
there's
an interesting part because Hachenberg's institute and the Hertz Institute was in East Germany, not in West Germany.
Right.
And as far as I know, the Russians gave a darn about any restrictions. And,
I see.
So, that was the amazing fact. When I first met Hachenberg, was at an Earthy meeting in Den Haag, which was either, it must have been 54 or 55.
You had to meet him outside the country. You had to meet him outside.
Yeah, yes. And there he reported about an eclipse, which just had happened before. And he, strange enough, represented the best solar measurements of this eclipse at high wavelength, high frequency, short wavelengths, 3 centimeters. And so they must have been very much advanced, but they had a lot of problems of getting tubes. And Lo and I remember one day giving him, when I visited East Germany, I brought him over a few diets at the time was 1N21C or so was probably the best thing, and I brought him a few of the low noise input stage tires, cascade tubes and things like this. So they obviously didn't have many restrictions, but he should know better, but they didn't have much material, so I think it was quite a performance to get those things running.
But now what about the Priester survey though? Was that held down by restrictions?
No.
So dipoles, I mean,
yes, it was
TV antennas and so forth, there was no restrictions on that sort of thing.
And of course also a receiver for 150 megahertz is nothing classified. It started only when you get into the range.
Yeah, okay.
High range.
So Brandt was the one that, the driving force behind getting the money for the...
Yes.
For the Stockert telescope. And why was his interest? I mean, was it just a matter of looking at other countries and saying that this was a good field to work in?
Yeah, I mean, he saw the possibility to get somehow back into this radar business via...
Through, I say.
Through radio astronomy. And in fact, when eventually the 25-meter telescope was built and ready, we had to give away a certain percentage of observing time for active radar work, because at that time the restrictions had fallen completely, and they had installed one of these high power 21 centimeter radar systems and made experiments which were classified. So when these people worked, we're not allowed to come into the Stockert building and so on. If they have ever done anything useful or not, I don't know. After 2 years, they left the place and we could take the instrument over.
And that was under Brandt's control, those experiments? Or?
Well, I think it was called one of these... it was the German Minister of Defense or so who controlled it somehow, but loosely, and what they actually did. I don't know. Well, so this 25-meter telescope, I think it was planned in either 53 or 54. No, it must have been 54. I went first back to Munich and finished my diploma, and then I started to work with University of Bonn, I think, early in 55 or late in 54, if I remember correctly. So at that stage, the initial planning had already been done. They had decided for a 25-meter telescope, primarily because at that time, the plans for the 25-meter telescope in Twingelow had also been advanced. And so Germany felt that they should have at least an equal telescope. And the telescope was, the work which they primarily wanted to do was 21 centimeter line observations.
And who set that decision?
Well, I think this decision was made by Bickel, but also before I came. In fact, when I looked into the planning of the receivers, I was a bit shocked to see that they had only provisions for measuring the line, and there were no provisions whatsoever to measure the continuum. So I sneaked in a sort of a continuum channel in order to make some continuum measurements. I think one of the basic mistakes which they made here was that they did not have any electronics development group here in the university itself. Everything was done by industry outside.
And contract too.
Yes, it was. They had the chief contractor was Telefunken, and then they had Zeppelin in Friedrichshafen, which built the telescope or the reflector, and company Alkit in Berlin that built the machine parts and so on. And Telefunken itself built the radio receiver. And so I had quite some influence on the way this receiver was built. We sneaked in this continuum channels and so on. I worked for about 1.5 years at Ulm with Telefunken. And then when the telescope was ready and the receiver was ready, we moved it up to the Stockholm. And then it took us another half a year, I would say at least, until then the electronic ran smoothly. And this must have been in the early 1957 or so. And I mean, at that time I still didn't have much feeling for what this whole thing was good for. I was relying that people here at the University of Bonn would know what to do.
Where to point it, yeah.
Yes, and this was a bit disappointing. In the end we did not get very much support. Priester, who was supposed to be the leading man, got sidetracked by the Sputnik. There were the early days of Sputnik, and one of our technicians was a ham, and he had some equipment, and so he immediately started to observe Sputnik, and then the TV people pulled in, and journalists and so on, and Priester did some of the early interpretations of satellite work, and he got so completely sidetracked that he's still in space research, and especially in higher atmospheres. That's where he came in through things. And his chair, which he holds nowadays, is for theoretical astrophysics and space research. But what he is doing is primarily physics of the higher atmosphere.
I see. What was he doing with Sputnik? Calculating the orbit and things like this?
Yes, calculating the orbit, calculating the slowing down, and and then they found inversion layers and the interpretation, all these things. I think he worked pretty closely together with the Goddard Institute, not in Greenbelt, but in Chastro and these people.
In New York, yeah.
So he was more or less lost for radio astronomy. And for those 21 centimeter profiles, there was not too much interest here by the rest of the people. They were this type of classical stellar astronomers with not much of a basis in astrophysics. And I just didn't understand enough to do any interpretational works.
But who made the decision originally, though, that the hydrogen line, or was that because the Dutch were very, very gung-ho on that and they thought that'd be good?
Well, okay, this could be the reason. As Bicker explained it to me, was that they, of course, he and especially his brother Wilhelm, who is still in Basel, he did a lot about investigating, exploring the structure of the galaxy. It was Wilhelm Bicker with all the clusters and associations and O stars and H2 regions, who always finds the three arms.
Right.
In the solar vicinity, and so they thought it's a consequence. But I mean, the whole matter of radio waves and receivers and so on, this was so far from these people here, and Friedrich Becker himself was no longer active. Then he had suffered from a heart attack, and from that time, I think he was more or less a teacher and an administrator, and so the group was practically headless.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Let me just verify what this person's name is. Is it Becker?
Becker, yeah.
B-E-C-K-E-R?
Yes,
right.
B-E-C. The name here was Friedrich Becker. And
Wilhelm is the one
still
active.
Yeah.
With galactic structure. Yeah.
Right. Well, and so then in 1959, I got so fed up with this 21 centimeter business that I had some talks with Westerhout in Leiden, whom we had visited several times, and he had visited us. And so I started continuum work. In fact, my first measurements was first I got interested in the radiation from the ground radiation, so we mapped the horizon of Stockard, and we could see how we actually got a picture of the thermal radiation from the ground. And then I found out that this could be used to calibrate the telescope.
A la Kopeck,
yeah. Yeah, with the one exception that we were aware of the effects of side lobes and on the back lobe, whereas the people in Goodwright did not. And so we, I calibrated the telescope and made at that time one of the first absolute measurements of Cassiopeia A and 4, then 4 other sources which we connected to it. And I think this value still stands today. I mean, with a large error bar, of course, but still it's it was one of the first absolute measurements.
And that's a 21 centimeter.
It was 21 centimeter. And then I decided, okay, this continuum, I understand more about it, and I understand how to make maps. And so I started to build an 11 centimeter super heterodyne receiver.
Let me just ask about the hydrogen line work. Was that ever published, any of that work, anywhere?
Well,
I'm not familiar with it at all.
I think they published it in the end in some obscure publication. I mean, it never was it Veröffentlichung der Sternwarte Bonn or something like this. I mean, it never made any any great hit.
Okay.
And
okay, I'm sorry. So back to the you built 11 centimeters.
Yes, I built an 11 centimeter. I again made some absolute calibrations of the antenna and so on. But primarily what we were setting out was a survey of the galactic plane at 11 centimeters. And I was joined in this effort by two graduate students from the University of Münster. Okay, I should perhaps say another work which I published, and I think which was quite successful at those days, was thermal radiation from the moon at 21 and 11 centimeters. And that's another story. I teamed up with Strassel, who was a complete positional astronomer, because I couldn't compute myself.
Vibrations.
And he's just gave me a table, and in this table he also gave me the diameter of the moon, and I was very much amazed to see that the diameter of the moon changes. And so I started my plots, and I saw that the thermal radiation of the moon was changing. And of course it was what I was expecting, because Pennington and Minet had published a couple of years ago their measurements at high frequencies, and it changed, and they attached this beautiful theory of the of the dust layer and so on, and so I expected the same thing. But then I realized that the diameter, and Akabane had done a similar thing at 11 centimeters and also found that it changed.
In Japan.
And then I did the same thing here and also found that it changed, but I also had this table where I found that the diameter of the telescope, of the moon also changes, and I did the convolution integral of a Gaussian beam with a disk. And after I did the thing and corrected it, came out a perfectly flat line. And we went back and checked Akarane's measurements and found that he was observing was just this effect of the variation of the diameter of the moon.
Right, and you don't get as much of an amplitude as you do at
it's completely flat.
1 centimeter.
It's completely flat. There's no amplitude whatsoever. And we got a good mean value of the moon. Okay, but these were signed things, and then we set out for this 11 centimeter survey, and I was joined by two graduate students from Münster, where Strassel had gone then as a professor, where Altenhoff and Wendker.
Strassel was here at Bonn?
Strassel was first here at Bonn and an associate professor, and then went to Münster, where he became a full professor for astronomy, and he taught, he still continued, including in his courses, radio astronomy. He had, of course, no instrument himself, but he had an arrangement whereby he could send his students. Right. So the first two who arrived were Wendker and Altenhoff.
I see.
And they were involved first in some 21 centimeter line observations, and but then I got them interested in this survey. And
what year is this now, just to see where? What year is this?
That was 1959. And so we got about 3 months' time on the 25 meter telescope, and we surveyed the galactic plane completely. And then in the interpretation, we teamed up with Gart Westerhout, who just was on his way to Maryland, and we got out the paper as quick as possible. And after this thing, I left astrophysics, discussed it, and went into the Siemens, back to the Siemens Research Laboratory.
That's this one right here.
Yeah, Altenhoff,
Metzger, Strassel, Wendker, and
Yeah.
Westerhout.
Yeah. And Wester Howard went to the University of Maryland, and Altner and Wendker went back to Münster to finish their thesis, I think. Altenhoff's work was on, he worked on the refraction and attenuation of radio waves by the atmosphere. That was all the sideline of this 11 centimeter survey.
And Wendker's thesis, was that in radio
astronomy? Wendker did his thesis much later. I'll come back to the thing.
Okay.
One thing I should mention, already at this 11 centimeter survey, someone had drawn my attention to a paper by Kardashev on the possibility of seeing those recombination lines. And when we considered what can we see at 11 centimeters, of course, H2 regions, and one looked at those H2 regions and one saw that they were all over the sky, so then someone showed me this paper by Kardashev, and we realized that if we could find recombination lines, we may be in a position to also to get kinematic distances of the H2 regions. So I had built in this 11 centimeter receiver a one channel spectrometer to scan the channels to look for these lines, but this experiment got never off the ground because we first wanted to complete the survey, and when the survey was completed there was no serving time left, and I wanted to leave astrophysics anyhow, radio astronomy, and so we finished. We never got a chance to look for the recombination lines.
And that was in 61, or...?
No, this was in 60. In 60, eventually, I left... In September of 60 or so, I left radio astronomy. I went back to Siemens and the research laboratories, and there I worked primarily on the development of parametric amplifiers. And my only connection then to radio astronomy was that because I worked in the research laboratory, I was not obliged to do anything directly related for commercial use. So we had an agreement here with Speckhoff that I was supposed to build a 21 centimeter param for the Stockhoff.
I see.
That's a sort of something, if you build something, you would like to see how it works. And since I did, and during that time I had quite some good connections with Brian Robinson, who at that time worked in the Netherlands, also on the development of parametric amplifiers. But he worked on an up converter. Or down, no, sorry, a down converter.
Yeah. No, not up converter.
An up converter. And I worked on directly on a straight parametric amplifier with not isolators, what's the other thing?
Circulator
and things like this. Well, anyhow, it was a two-stage parametric amplifier which had a gain stabilization by a servo loop which controlled the diode current, and it was quite a successful thing. We finished it after 2 years and brought it up to the Stockhoff and built it in, and I think it worked there for 3 or 4 years approximately, again for 21 centimeter line measurements. Shortly after I had left Bonn, Hachenberg took over, first as an associate professor, later on as a full professor. What has happened was that his institute where he worked was in East Berlin. He himself was living in West Berlin, and they built the Berlin Wall on a Sunday, so he was in the right part. And so he had some negotiations, but they forced him to either resign or move with his family over, and so he resigned. And then Becker got him the job here, and Hachenberg had taken over.
But he did get to bring his family. He did get to bring his family with him.
Yeah, yes. Anyway, I mean, his family was in West Berlin.
Oh, they were in West Berlin already.
Yeah,
that's right. The whole family was there.
So he didn't have any problems. Okay, what has happened here, how they started this 80 or 100 meter telescope, that's a story, which I don't know, which Hachenberg should know all about. Fate was this, that I... Already during the time when I worked with Siemens, I got a few offers from the United States. One was from Krauss, another was from another place. And eventually I got this offer from Heeshan. And at the time I was decided to make an industrial career. But anyhow, it was interesting to go to the United States. And so I negotiated with Heeshan that I was coming for 1 year as an associate research associate.
Mm-hmm.
And I came over, but I was primarily interested at that time in instruments, so I set out and did all the testing of the NIO, Green Bank telescopes. It was, they had this beautiful photogrammetric, I don't know. Anyhow, it was a survey from a helicopter where they could measure actually the best fit deviations of the paraboloids.
From a helicopter?
Yeah, from a helicopter. They made stereometric photographs.
I see.
And so they had surveyed all the reflectors of the 300-foot telescope and on the 85-foot Tadal telescope.
Right.
And so they knew what the deviations were. And I, of course, knew John Roos's theory of tolerance theory, which was never published. And so I thought, my God, a fantastic possibility to check this theory. And so we did measurements, and Heeshan was very sympathetic for those experiments, and he gave me all the help. And we checked the 300-foot telescope then down to 10 centimeters, and the Tate telescope down to about 1.9 centimeters. And we found, we could confirm Roos's theory, and we checked out the telescopes, and we, at the same time we continued some work on high-resolution observations of galactic sources. And now if I say we, this means there was Jaap Bals, who had at that time come over, and I also had gotten Wendker from Münster, who wanted to do his thesis work. So through some arrangement, we could get him over to Green Bank, and he worked with me and with Jaap Bals. Jaap Bals were also primarily instrumental-minded, and Wendker was a guy with the basic astronomical knowledge.
And when did you go to the States?
It was 64. I think both of them arrived in 64.
And let me just also ask, with this 21 centimeter parent that you built that was used for several years,
yeah.
I guess that was used mainly while you were in the States.
Yes, I didn't have to do anything.
So you never took part in those observations?
No, no. Altenhof and I did some measurements with this parent just to check it out and published just these results as a proof how those experimental amplifiers were, but this was the end, and I was completely disconnected.
Who were the people that worked with it mainly, just for my information?
Well, I think there was Rolfs and Girnstein, who is now in the computer division here, and Felden. Oh, I think all people who are still around, but never have published very much.
Right. I mean, these things are not known at all.
No, it's more or less the thing, the effort was completely lost, and I really don't know what was the reason why the thing here never got off the ground.
Okay, but anyway, back to the States. So you worked first on the parabolas, surfaces of them.
Yes.
At Green Bank.
And then I was always interested in observations at very high frequencies, so I persuaded Heeshan. Oh, okay, and at that time there was also Frank Lowe, who worked at 1 millimeter. And I persuaded Heeshan and Watum, who was at that time head of the electronics division, that we should make an effort to bridge the gap between 1 millimeter and, say, 2 centimeters where we were working. And we started a millimeter wave laboratory, where I was the head of this thing, and Rama Menon, Menon's wife, was working as an engineer, and Neil Albo, who is still with the 36-foot telescope out in Tucson, they were my first people, and later on we got some technicians.
I see.
And however, we ordered the spare parts, we ordered the parts for the millimeter wave receiver, which is always a time lag of about 1/2 year. And so in the meantime, we thought, what else can we do? And at Green Bank, at that time, we had a maser at 6 centimeter. Which was a horrible thing. It was built by Airborne Instruments and never ever got off the ground. We wasted weekends and nights and so on to get it work, and it never would. I mean, it hang on the telescope and then it worked for 10 minutes. And
yes.
During these 10 minutes, one got beautiful, fantastic measurements, and then it broke down and was again broken down. And so, in the end, everybody was disgusted that the maser was put in some corner. And I had this millimeter wave laboratory. We didn't really know what to do. So I asked Vatom if he had anything against if he dismantled this maser and took the second stage. Was a high noise harem, so to say, 400 degrees or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to look again for the recombination lines. And because Höglund just had completed a 20-channel receiver for Morton Roberts to look for 21 centimeter lines and extra connected systems, he had the right channel widths.
Right.
So Höglund and I decided we worked together and we built that receiver. And we nailed it together, and at that time, the 140-foot telescope just got into operation. This was in 1965.
Yeah.
And I must say, okay, I told you in the beginning that I was only for, I first came over for only 1 year. But when I had seen the 140-foot telescope, I immediately had fallen in love with this instrument. I realized this as a, when this right. instrument is in operation, this is a thing. The biggest instrument. And so when Heeshan offered me to stay, I decided immediately to stay.
Right.
And my people and Siemens were not too happy about this decision, but on the other hand, they took it nicely. And so after this 1 year was over, I moved over, took all my furniture and everything over
mm-hmm.
in a big box and became a permanent staff member. Well, and that was at the time when we just before I left to go back to Germany, we had completed the first version and we put it in the Tatel telescope. And I was no longer around when they made some... Yeah, I was there for the first measurements, but then I had to leave and Höglund took over. And when I came back, I saw the results. It was rather strange. We had sometimes there was something which looked like a line, but then at other stages we did